everyone. Welcome to Stutter Talk. This is co-host Peter Reitzes. Co-host Eric Jackson is in the production booth for this episode. And I'd like to welcome to the show a very special guest who we have lured out of retirement, Dr. Eugene B. Cooper. Dr. Cooper, are you with us today?
I certainly am. Looking forward to our talk.
It is a pleasure and an honor to have you on this show. I'm going to ask you to sit through a summary, a bio of your work, and then we'll get started. Dr. Eugene Cooper is a professor and chair emeritus of the University of Alabama's Department of Communication Disorders and distinguished professor emeritus at Nova Southeastern University's program in speech-language pathology. Dr. Cooper, you've been studying stuttering, I think, for 60-plus years, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, I have. Would you like to know a little bit about how I got into that mess?
I would, but believe it or not, I want to just read a couple points of your bio. Dr. Cooper is a fellow of the American Speech Language Hearing Association, and in 1999, you received the honors of the association, which is quite a prestigious award. So how did you get interested in stuttering and speech therapy, Dr. Cooper?
Okay, and cut me off if I go on too long.
Okay.
It all happened. I was a student at the State University of New York at Geneseo, and I had gone there as a major in drama, and I was interested in acting, and so that's how I got to Geneseo. And it turned out that at that point, there was a Miss C. Agnes Rigney, who was one of the early pioneers. She had done work at Columbia University. And so she had just introduced a curriculum at Geneseo called speech correction at that time. And but I was there as a drama student, and as part of the curriculum, she forced all speech and hearing in the speech department, everyone to take a course in speech correction. And so in addition to that, I became a host at the College Center. Well, Miss Rigney was one of those pioneers who set up a program for stutterers in the northwest area of New York State. She had people coming in from all over. I was the host at the College Center on a part-time job, and she asked me if I wouldn't welcome them when they come in at every Thursday or something like that in the afternoon. And so I would greet them, and then I would take them to lunch. I noticed that so many of them came in with their arms in a sling. And I said, what in the world is this? I said, what are stutterers, klutzy or something, that they break their arms? And so I asked Miss Rigney, I said, what is this that so many of these folks have their arms in a sling? And she described that the fact is that stuttering was related to a mixed dominance problem, that no side of the brain, there should be one side that controls the other side, and that part of the therapy was that they had to reinforce their sightedness, and so that they would put their arms in a sling and then just use their right hand and rather than their left hand, if they were left-handed. And it was at that time that thinking that left-handed people would more frequently face the problem of stuttering than the general population.
So your introduction to stuttering was meeting people who stutter wearing slings because of a theory of dominance. That's incredible.
Yes.
And yeah, I also want to let you know that I'm left-handed, and people still occasionally ask me if my stuttering is related to being left-handed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that was a very major theory based on Edward Lee Travis's interpretation of some work done by a guy named Orton. And so that was very popular back in the, I'm going to say the 30s and the 40s, early 40s. I was fascinated by that. At any rate, I did graduate there, but...
Were you there with Hal Starbuck? Had Hal Starbuck started?
No. I was pre-Harold Starbuck.
Okay.
I got my degree there. Miss Rigney got me an assistantship at Penn State and I thought she was getting me an assistantship in theater because she was head of the speech department, so that's how naive I was. But anyway, when I got down to Penn State and moved in, I appeared at the speech and hearing clinic, which I was not surprised at because Genesee was so small that the speech and hearing clinic was in Miss Rigney's office. So.
Oh, wow.
But at any rate, there I was. I appeared and I knew nothing about, really, I planned to go into theater and proceed, but there I was. I had an assistantship. I didn't have a dollar in my name, and I was planning to live on this stipend. So we met in a big room, and this man came in, and his name was Siegenthaler, and he was head of the department at that time at Penn State in terms of the speech and hearing clinic. And he handed out a paper with our assignments, and there was about, I'm going to say 18 to 20 people in the room that were all new students, and first job was to screen 6,000 incoming freshmen. Can you imagine? For speech,
no.
And, speech and hearing problems. And on the list it said Eugene Cooper, and then I read it and it said audio meter in room such and such. And so I'm starting to shake, and so, I really was panicked. And then people start standing. He went around the room and wanted to know where everybody was from. And this person stood up and said, "My name's Kate Blodgett, and I'm from Michigan, and I studied under Van Riper." And everyone went, "Ooh," like that, in
yeah.
the room. Oh man, he was, and. I sat there and looked, and I said, "Holy cow." And then somebody stood up and said, "My name is Don Rhodes, and I studied under Mullendore at UVA. And everybody went, "Woo," kind of. And these people kept standing up. My name was, and I can't remember these names all together, but one stood up and said that she was Henry or something from Iowa, and I studied under, here's where I have word problem.
Is it Wendell Johnson or Dean Williams?
Yeah, Wendell Johnson.
Okay.
She said, and Wendell Johnson, well, when she said that, it was, the room, ooh.
That's great.
So anyways, I'm sitting there thinking, oh my God, this is something. And so finally it got to me, and by this I was cringing down in my seat, and I said, "What am I going to say? I studied under Miss Rigney."
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that was my introduction. So, but I was sitting there panicked because I said, "Well, audio meter, I don't even know what an audio meter is." And so after the meeting adjourned and we were all supposed to go to our spots where we were beginning to test the students, I went up to this Dr. Siegenthaler and I said, "Dr. Siegenthaler," I said, I don't know what an audio meter is. And he said, "The name is Siegenthaler and you'll do, and it's audiometer and you'll do speech."
Huh.
And so that's when I became a speech pathologist. And that's how I happened to get into this whole field. But I had known that experience about stuttering, and it fascinated me. And so, of course, one of the first graduate courses I took was in stuttering. And I've been fascinated with it ever since.
It sort of, it reminds me of those stories where I'm in New York, so people will talk about their experiences at Ellis Island where they get off the boat and they're given a name, and from now on you will be known as. And it's,
yeah.
It's sort of like a similar story, like from now on you will be a speech-language pathologist.
That's right.
So I think it's safe to say that the standards in the field have changed a little bit since then.
Oh, markedly.
Well, let's just dive in. I mean, when I was a graduate student, I was having some challenges, and everybody said, call Dr. Gene Cooper. So you were one of the first people I met in the field, and you helped me deal with a case of discrimination, which I'm very thankful for. And I know that you've helped a lot of people. In fact, a regular guest on Stutter Talk, Bob Quisel, said to me, and he said I could share this on air, that you were one of the truly great guys of our profession. And coming from Bob, I think that's very special.
Oh, yes, yes.
There are so many questions I want to ask you. Let's start with, you were asked by the National Stuttering Project, now the National Stuttering Association, to write them a very short article, just a page, on how to choose a speech therapist. One of the many interesting things is you wrote to people who stutter that we need a clinician and not a technician. What's the difference between a clinician and a technician?
Well, a clinician deals with the totality of the person, and the idea of a technician would just hook them up to wires and shock them if they did this. You know, they would treat the person as just at the other end of a machine, but a clinician deals with the total person. I've used for, I don't know how many years, 40 years, the concept of the ABCs of stuttering. That the affective and behavioral and cognitive aspects. And so a clinician is one who encompasses those three areas in any treatment program. That makes a clinician. Technicians is just one probably force or bases, looks at the problem of stuttering from a behavioral problem and just treats it in that way.
Yeah, when I was a grad student, I remember calling you on the phone, and I shared with you that somebody in my university speech department was telling us graduate students that it's unethical to ever ask a client how they feel. Our job is to simply reduce stuttering. So, I mean, wouldn't that be an example?
That person would obviously be a technician rather than a clinician. You know,
yeah.
In my conceptualization.
You know, Dr. Cooper, you wrote, and I want to quote you here, there is nothing more important to success in therapy than your relationship with your clinician. So what you're really saying, and you said it throughout your career, is that the speaking strategies, the speech tools, are not nearly as important as the relationship between the client and the therapist. Were you one of the very first people to say that?
Well, I guess I was. I was in charge of the stuttering program at the doctoral level. When I came back and was working for the doctoral program, working on my doctorate, and then as part of my traineeship, or whatever it was called, I ran the stuttering program there. It was an intensive stuttering therapy program during the summer for teenagers, and then the rest of the year, the Vocational Rehabilitation Service Administration actually paid these folks to come there and get rehabbing in stuttering. And so my job was to run those groups. And it became quickly evident to me that the more important thing was, treating them as a whole person. My dissertation was on the client-clinician relationship and trying to measure it and see what its effect was, how it related to progress in therapy. And that was, in the early, I guess it was the late 50s
that
I did that. So that, it became clearly evident to me that the relationship was a key factor here. So I began writing about that. And then, I don't know whether you know Walt Manning or not.
Actually, Walter Manning, and I spoke to Walter Manning a few days ago because I knew you guys worked together. So he sort of helped me prep a few questions.
Oh, well, good for him. He was a student of mine, and his first publication was with me on the client-clinician relationship. And so he has always been And he's been committed to that aspect of the treatment program. And then my wife, she completed a thesis with me on the client-clinician relationship. And so that we did that early research about its significance in treatment programs.
So, I mean,
you're right, I've been a lifetime, I guess I would say, in my whole career, that's been a key focus.
Which I think is so interesting because, I mean, we've had Walter Manning on the show. We spoke a few weeks ago to Patricia Zabrowski from the University of Iowa, and they're both publishing on this topic now, and they're both discussing research that's being done on this topic in related fields such as counseling.
Sure.
And I sort of feel like you predicted the future a little bit because, I mean, I don't know this for sure, but it feels like it took 40 or 50 years for the ideas you sort of planted seeds for to start to see the light of day.
I think there's some accuracy in what you're saying. I really do.
Yeah, it's really interesting. At the time, just for our listeners really understand this, you were talking about the importance of the client-clinician relationship before the Beatles even had a hit. I mean, this is like, so how did your colleagues take that? Like, what did people in the field think about this idea that the speech tool isn't nearly as important as a relationship?
You know, I had a lot of resistance. I talked about the frequency fallacy. In my interaction with my colleagues across the nation, and stuff. That's where I began to be kind of almost like a preacher trying to deliver some sermons. And I, coined the term frequency fallacy. And I said that this was, a major problem in the field, that the folks kept focusing on the fluency and as opposed to focusing on the total person and helping them because, in other words, they were missing out. They focused on behavior but did nothing with the affective and the cognitive aspects of the problem. And so I got a lot of flack for that kind of talking. And, of course, when I then developed the chronicity prediction checklist, because I began to say that, there is some stuttering that, it quotes, is not curable in the sense. And that really drew a lot of red flags. And as a matter of fact, this was one of the things that Bob and I got into because he really attacked me for suggesting that there are people who didn't recover from fluency.
Is this Bob Quisel?
Yeah, Bob Quisel.
Okay, so you're saying that it was controversial. Well, actually, let's just move back a step. So you came out with an idea that I think still is a little controversial. You called it chronic perseverative stuttering syndrome.
Right. Yeah. But that there's a 1% of individuals who are disfluent who truly are chronic. That is that it's not curable. I hate to use that word, but they can be, we use the word that they can conquer it, but they, the stuttering by the things handling it from, the way they feel about it and the way that they think about it and that they can control it to the extent, not that they're ever going to be totally fluent because there may very well not be. Dan Riper, for example, I got a lot of flack on that, and I have hanging in my office a letter from Van Riper the year that I presented the chronic perseverative stuttering, and he wrote me a letter. He said, I just wanted to tell you that the speech you made at convention was not only courageous but magnificent. I did not hear it. My traveling days are over. But I read it in the NSP newsletter where it appeared. And so that was the reaction. He said, yes, a lot of stuttering, perhaps most of it, is incurable. And the operant people have created as much evil as did their ancestors. Benjamin Bogue, for example, with their emphasis on not stuttering.
Right.
And this goes on, but then he says, again, I mean, I express my admiration and respect. And he said, I have been, this is, I'm quoting Van Riper now in this letter that he wrote, I have been fluent for years, but only because I learned how to control my stuttering. At 81, I still stutter, as I always have. And indeed, I am grateful. I'd have been a bum in the woods near Lake Superior otherwise. I owe much to my disorder. It's possible to have a wonderful, creative life despite it. And then he ends up, again, thanks for that. So it's, that was a really kind of a nice support.
Yeah.
And then did I have that thing?
You know what? Could I just jump over for just a second here? Being the age I am, it's a little hard for me to wrap my head around all of this, around to why your concept or idea of chronic perseverative stuttering syndrome was so controversial. Let me just read a few things. So you have called for the field to acknowledge the existence of the chronic perseverative stuttering syndrome and for establishing realistic therapy goals in view of its existence. And you've gone on to say, I do not believe all stutterers can be fluent. That doesn't strike me as particularly controversial now. Why was that controversial then?
I don't know. because they were the people believed that all stuttering could be cured if the person would just buckle down and do it. One of the things, like, here's Bob Kuiesel. I love him dearly, but he was one who was really concerned about naming an incurable stuttering. But anyway, he was quite concerned about it. And so Bob's question, he wrote to me, if someone comes to you and says that the chronic perseverative stuttering syndrome is nothing but a fabrication because there is no published data to support, how would you respond? And remembering the thing about that, yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus, and so I modeled a response to him, and this was just fun between the two of us. And I'm going to take a moment to read it, and you can edit out all this if you want.
Okay.
So I wrote, Dear Robert, yes, Robert, there is a chronic perseverative stuttering syndrome. It resides in the mind, body, and soul of all those individuals who, no matter how much energy, time, and effort they expend in their pursuit of fluency, find that fluency, as most individuals experience, is said, continues to elude them.
Well, you know, I actually have that in front of me.
You have that in front of me?
I do. It's from
How'd you get that?
That's from the International Stuttering Awareness Day archives. That's from 2000. Yeah, it's still published. It's still up on Judy Custer's website, which was why we love Judy, because she's remarkable how much she manages to.
Oh, my word. I didn't know that. I thought that was a personal thing between Bob and I, but I guess it wasn't.
But you know, I'll tell you, Bob was just playing devil's advocate there. And he said so. He said, I'm just being devil's advocate here.
That's right. Bob. Right. And I love him dearly because of that. He was always controversial.
Right, so here's the thing I want to get at. And actually, this topic's been coming up on Stutter Talk a lot recently. So what I think you're saying is that fluency may not be... Oh, and by fluency, you're talking about the absence of stuttering. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the absence of stuttering may not be achievable for all people who stutter. Is that what you're getting at?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
And here's the thing. I, I don't know if that's right or if that's wrong, but from a therapeutic perspective, what would you expect a clinician to do with that? And the reason I ask is because, you know, when I'm sitting across from a client who stutters, whether they're an adult or a teenager, you know, I don't want to say to them, you can be fluent if you just work hard enough. But I also don't want to say to them, you can't be fluent no matter how hard you try. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just want to be there to help them explore their stuttering and to do the very best they can to meet their goals. So I guess the question is, what do you want the clinician or the graduate student to do with this information?
You address the ABCs, about the way they feel about it, and, so that they become aware. The idea is that you can educate a person into different strategies that they can use to develop, and this is why a key feature in all of our work has been that we do not use fluency as a thing to determine success in therapy. What we do is, if we can help a person develop a feeling of fluency control, that is, give them strategies, both attitudinal and behavioral and cognitive, the way they think about their stuttering, so that they can feel that they are, quotes, in control of it, even if they do have some fluency problems.
You know, I want to stop you there, Dr. Cooper, because that is a topic I really want to talk to you about. I think it's time we take a short break and then come on back for more Stutter Talk.
Okay.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping still. I can't see.
Hi, this is Tricia Zabrowski from the University of Iowa, and you are listening to Stutter Talk.
Hi, this is Hannah from the Central New Jersey chapter of the National Stuttering Association. I'm a member of a self-help group for people who stutter, and we meet at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. At these bi-weekly meetings, a broad spectrum of people who stutter discuss the challenges and rewards of living with stuttering and coping strategies. We support each other as we strive to live productive and dignified lives with stuttering. For more information about the meetings, contact me at 732-549-5039 or visit the NSA website at www.westutter.org.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. Peter Reitz is here with very special guest, Dr. Eugene B. Cooper. I'm so glad we could lull you out of retirement. For our listeners who don't know, you are recovering from two strokes. So we just can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with us here on Stutter Talk. I think you were one of the very first people to stand up and say that at its core, stuttering is a loss of control. Do I have that right?
Well, yes, I wouldn't argue with that, but continue to ask me on that.
I should say this a different way. When I was preparing for the show, I was speaking to a few people about your contributions to the field. And one of the things that people kept saying was that you are very responsible for this idea that at its core, the problem of the person who stutters is feeling a loss of control, feeling that they're not in control of their speech. And that,
I will buy into that, what you just said.
Yeah, and so I almost feel like you haven't gotten really a lot of credit for that really basic idea that stuttering is a loss of control.
Yeah.
In 1977, you wrote, "More important than any single technique was the feeling of control that a stutterer obtained if able to use a variety of controls in most speaking situations. The end goal of therapy became that of developing a feeling of control." What does that mean, developing a feeling of control?
Well, it's not only a thinking, it's a feeling thing. It's an emotional reaction to their lack of control. It's accepting the fact that if the person is disfluent, their world doesn't come to an end, nor does it mean that they can't do what they want to do. So that's the kind of feeling that you try to develop in them, and they earn that feeling by the way they think and the way they feel about their things, as well as how successful they are in using motoric, changing the behavior that they have. They don't shake, they don't blink their eyes, they don't shake their heads, things like that, so that they know, well, gee, here I am, I've got it down to what we always call the core of stuttering, the fact that they may be disfluent, but it doesn't throw them, nor does it interfere with their intelligibility. I don't know whether that's responsive to you, to what you're getting at.
No, it is, and what's most interesting about that is that you're defining the end goal of therapy as not necessarily the absence of stuttering, or not necessarily a reduction of stuttering. It sounds like you're defining the end goal as feeling in control with speaking and with communication.
Absolutely. That very, very effective speakers can be disfluent. And that they can feel good about it.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Now, you've been working in stuttering for more than 60 years. It's a very long time. How has your thinking changed in those 60 years?
Well, let's see. You grow up, you kind of go with the flow. When I first went into this thing, Van Riper, Wendell Johnson's, and I think that probably one of the first things that I began to believe in was Wendell Johnson's idea, that his conclusion that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the person who stutters physically or mentally. It's the problem is one of the way they see themselves, that it's a semantic problem, that, and he focused on that to gain the feeling of control, and going back to that because that's what he wanted, was there was nothing physically wrong, and that they could, if they saw themselves more accurately and perceived themselves, they could do things to become acceptably fluent. And so that was the period when you were thinking about the fact that stuttering was definitely a physical problem of some sort. I mean, it was not a physical problem of some sort. And then it kind of wafted into the days in the 40s when the feeling became, with the development of, like, Carl Rogers' theories of clinical activity, getting the person to work towards self-actualization. And then it lifted from focusing on the motoric aspects of the problem to the feelings, and that the goal was to develop the happy stutterer. That is, that they didn't necessarily become fluent, but they just became, feeling good about themselves. And that can be achieved through the counseling aspects of it. So that was focusing on developing the happy stutterer kind of thing. And that so psychotherapy was kind of the key thing. And then along came the 60s, and that's when the great rush of behaviorism came in. And I can remember, the operant procedures, and that's when actually I got involved, and I was fascinated by the thought, doing electroshock therapy with folks where you would be punishing, in terms of the operant mode, their serving behavior. And so we did research in that area. David Bailey, I think of him because that was some of the first research we did in that area, so that I quickly became disaffected with that approach to treating stuttering as an operant problem, that we can just learn how to punish it and that we can overcome it that way. So I that didn't take with me. And I can remember one time, one article that I think was a milestone was that Wrong, Right, and Tree article.
And yes.
It was sort of I don't want to say that, but that it was a major put down of the operant people. That it wasn't anything punishing. It was just something drawing attention to, kind of thing.
Let's draw that article out a bit, because I wanted to ask you about that. So in, I think it was the 70s, you conducted an article, a research project, a study on, I think, 16 adults who stutter. And you used three verbal contingencies. So you used the words right, wrong, and tree in response to their stuttering. And what happened?
Well, it made no difference. If they said right, the people continued to be disfluent. So that that all three became, if you want to call them, punishers. So that it didn't mean that you were, that this concept of setting up punishment and reinforcement kind of thing was not really all that helpful as a clinical activity.
So I was trying to figure out why I found that article so interesting. Because, I mean, it's fascinating that I think what you're getting at is that when you respond to somebody's stuttering, it might not necessarily mean which word you use. It's the simple fact that you're stopping them. Was that pretty much it?
Well, that's right. That's right. And it was interesting because the article was replicated. David Daly and, I can't remember his co-author on that, the name of the co-author. But anyway, they replicated the study, found exactly the same thing that we had found. And then I'll never forget Marcel Wingate when in writing about that. It's sort of said that the concept of punishment as being the extinguisher of stuttering is not appropriate.
Well, and I'm looking, that article was from 1970, your original article on right, wrong, and tree.
It's
so great. Why I find it interesting is I don't know how much you've been keeping up with the recent research, but there's been quite a few studies done on Lidcombe therapy, which is an operant conditioning therapy for preschoolers who stutter, and now they're starting to use it with school-age children.
I'm aware of the program.
I don't know if you're familiar enough with it to comment generally on what you think about it.
No, I'm not. I'm not that familiar.
Well, then you don't have to respond to this question, but the reason I was bringing it up is because I think it's one thing to do operant conditioning therapy with preschoolers. I think it's something very different to do it with school-aged children. So now that there seems to be a push to use Lidcombe therapy with school-aged children, I do worry about what that will mean. But
I do too. I agree with you.
Good. So maybe Center Talk is going to be doing a show on Lidcombe in probably December, so we'll have more time to talk about that on air.
Oh, where you lay your head tonight, I'll roll away alone and close on down.
Do you have time for a few more questions, Dr. Cooper?
Sure, of course I do.
And actually, I didn't mean to cut you off. So the last question I asked you was, what have you learned in 60-plus years of therapy? If you had to boil it down to one talking point, would you be able to do that?
Well, I have a thing called Facts About Stuttering, and where I sort of summarize it, and then I say that the bottom line is that there's good news, because even if they are a chronic perseverative stutterer, that they can't perhaps cure it, but they can conquer it as a disability. And that's what I think is the good news about it. If it's handled correctly, and if all of the various components, affective, behavioral, and cognitive, are handled and appropriately, well, then it ceases to be, quote, a major problem in a person's life. So I think that basically there's good news.
And I think that's really important to hear and to say. You know, you have been so involved in speech language pathology. I can't read all the things you've done, but, I mean, you were an executive officer for the Council of Academic Programs, for the National Council of State Boards of Examiners in Speech Language Pathology and Audiology. You were very instrumental, as far as I understand it, in specialty recognition for stuttering.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So when you look back on not only stuttering, but the field of speech language pathology, what do you think? I mean, are we in a good state with speech language pathology, or are you concerned about where the field is right now?
Well, now, if you're talking about operational aspects of it, the discipline as a whole is obviously going to survive and survive very nicely. But if you want to get specific about things that I feel, you know, haven't gone just right, am I pleased with what happened with specialty certification after it got launched? And I'll be very blunt. We spent a lot of energy and effort in doing it, but after then, the next few generations of leaders in that field, they got so anally oriented that they killed what I thought was a great opportunity to bring a lot of people into the profession. In other words, they created so many barriers to people getting it that they failed to get the mass of people that you needed to then really begin to form and shape. So that I think that one of the problems in the continued lack of individuals who are specialists is because they took the wrong approach and made it made it too difficult. And it's kind of tough to pare down and kind of to go back and kind of open the door for individuals who are interested in, you know, being considered therapists. Do you get what I'm saying?
No, I do get what you're saying, and you know, I've been a little critical of specialty recognition on this show before, and I've drawn some heat for that. Some people don't want any criticism at all, which I think is unfortunate, but I do know that you are very instrumental in bringing about specialty recognition. Do you want to be any more specific? Like, you mentioned barriers to specialty recognition. Would you want to name one of the barriers? I'm not asking to name people.
Now, my understanding about the tests they developed, for example, and a lot of effort and time and good people worked on that, but apparently that became, you know, a barrier. The barrier in terms of the rigid way that it was being monitored for people who joined in was problematic. And of course, at the beginning, there were no sponsors that could help, and that's why I think that after its initial start, then they began to build barriers to people coming into the discipline as specialists, and well, I think that was an error. That was a major error.
You may be pleased then to hear that, as far as I understand it, they very recently withdrew that test. So as far as I understand it, that written examination is no longer part of the process.
I understood. I'd heard that.
Which is also, it's very interesting because on the one hand, you criticize them for that, but on the other hand, other people have said, well, wait a second, you're making it too easy if you don't have that test.
If they had acted back when we had started the thing and opened, made it kind of open to people, you know, who just showed an interest in that then they could superimpose over the succeeding generations. But they would have to have a mass of people to do that, to make it successful. Do you know what I'm saying? When you start something, what the succeeding boards did, they just made it terribly difficult for someone to get it.
Well, I've drawn fire for saying that one of the reasons I have not personally become a board-recognized fluency specialist is just because I've heard enough people talk about how difficult the process is. That I didn't want to subject myself to it. And it's a shame because I've said that on air and I thought I've said it in a productive way, but then I get emails from people who are very angry that I would dare say that.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's upsetting. I mean, I got one email suggesting that I was misrepresenting information, which, you know, in ASHA speak, that's an ethical violation.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's discouraging that, you know, we try to make stutter talk. I mean, you've said that you curse the darkness and you have spent a career trying to light candles. And I've been impressed. You wrote that in one of your early papers.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you wrote cursing the dark. That you got. You know what? I'm going to find the exact quote, Dr. Cooper, because I think that is quotable. So I can cut all this mangling out. And let me find the quote, because I have it on my computer. So you wrote in 1986, you wrote that you would begin by cursing the darkness in an attempt to light a few candles. I think that's one of the things that Stutter Talk is about. It's just talking about these issues, trying to bring light. In the recent International Stuttering Awareness Day online conference over at the Stuttering homepage, which is the wonderful site by Judy Custer, there's been a topic raised about our most speech-language pathologists, are school-based speech-language pathologists really qualified to work with children who stutter? And it's a topic that some people get very upset when we bring it up, and I think it's important. It's a very important topic because I work in the schools, and I have never, ever heard of a school-based speech-language pathologist going to their supervisor and recusing themselves from working with a child. I mean, I cannot ever recall a speech pathologist in my district or in my schools saying to the supervisor, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not properly trained in stuttering. I can't work with that child. That would be insubordination. You could lose your job over that in the New York City public schools.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that. I mean, speech language pathology, like, what do we do when we have a situation where so many speech language pathologists are in the schools and have children on their caseload who stutter, yet might not feel qualified to work with that child? Like, what do we do as a field?
Good question. I don't know that it's answerable, but I see, I mean, I agree with your description of the problem. I see evidence of it almost every day. I did see evidence when I was going into the speech and hearing center. At times it's very discouraging when former students, you see them doing things and you hear about what they're doing that are just, you know, really blatantly, in my perception, wrong. Mm-hmm. And it happens all the time, but I guess that happens in every profession. But I don't know what to do about it, other than to kind of educate all the educators.
I mean, it's tough. I was at staff development a few days ago, and somebody comes up to me, and they, you know, very nice person, and the person said, and they're a licensed speech pathologist, mm-hmm. and they say to me, I'm working with a school-age child stutters, don't know what to do, so we're working on deep breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And when the child stutters, I tell the child to relax.
Yeah.
You know, almost like an operant conditioning type of thing. The child stutters, I say, relax.
Yeah.
And I say, well, why are you doing that? Well, isn't that what you're supposed to do? That's what they say. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? I say, well, I don't know that to be true. I don't know if there's any evidence at all that when a child stutters, they should be taking a deep breath and the therapist should say, relax. And I'm trying to be polite about it because I don't want to scare the person off. But those are like the real life conversations I have with people. So I suggest, well, why don't we talk? I'll send you a couple articles. I'll make some common suggestions like, well, have you asked the child about stuttering? Have you talked about stuttering? Have you asked the child to describe their stuttering? But it's discouraging when these are the type of conversations that I think it's safe to say routinely take place.
I see that. I still see that, and I hear about it. You know, that's too bad. I think that it's real what you're saying. So, I mean, I don't think there's anything more important. Now you're going to get me into my philosophical set about.
Okay.
I swear to God that most of the people that that take my courses, and you want to say to them, now don't ever tell anybody you took a course in me, because I know that they didn't get it.
Yeah.
It's very discouraging to know what you think you're teaching them things. Well, Crystal talks about it every day. She comes home and she's continuing to teach, and that students will ask, well, no, after taking our course and being provided very specific materials and all they have to follow, they say, how do I start therapy with this person who stutters? And you just want to cry.
Yeah.
And you say, oh God.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Get a brain or something.
Now I feel in your shoes because I get. Yeah, I don't teach grad school anymore, but I was an adjunct at three universities and you know, I had some great students, but I also got a lot of exactly what you're talking about. I sometimes think, and I could be wrong, but sometimes I get the feeling that some students go into a class and come out of the class with the same views.
Yeah.
How could you take an entire course on stuttering and come out of the course and think that when a child stutters, your role is to say, take a deep breath and relax.
Yeah.
Like, isn't that what you're bringing into the course? Take a deep breath and relax. Isn't that what you're starting with?
Yeah.
So to come out and to say that, it's almost unexplainable.
Oh, you know, Carl Rogers said, he was my hero back in the 50s, said that he didn't believe he ever taught anybody anything. He said that what he does is just kind of like provide a buffet for them, and they come in and select what they want anyway, so that I don't teach. I just make aware, hopefully give people stuff to chew on if they want.
Mm.
Most of them don't want.
So most of them don't chew on it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm going to try to bring this into a happier place now because we've been appropriately critical, I think.
Hi, this is Lee Caggiano with Friends, the National Association for Young People Who Stutter. We are a volunteer not-for-profit organization providing support and education for young people who stutter, their families, and speech therapists. I encourage you all to join us. It's really an experience that you won't get anywhere else. You get to spend days, hours with kids who stutter, their families, and really get a feel for what it's like to be a child who stutters, or the parent of a child who stutters. You can find us at www.friendswhostutter.org.
Hey, this is Dan from the Central Wisconsin chapter of the National Stuttering Association, and you're listening to Stutter Talk.
And I can't give you the year. I wish I would have written down the years, but I've reviewed so many of your articles for this show, and I wrote down a few quotes I really like. So you wrote, "We start off assuming that all stutterers are healthy neurotics, like most of us fluent people." So what did you mean by that?
Oh my gosh, did I write that?
So I'm not being fair, am I? I thought this would trigger like oh yeah, I know exactly what I meant.
I can see it in context, but I mean what I was getting at. I think that's a healthy way to look at it in a way. All of us are neurotic to extents and the various extents.
I think that's kind of like this idea I've expressed on the show before, that no matter how weird stuttering might seem to people, it's all pretty normal amongst people who stutter. Like, all the stuttering reactions we see for people who stutter, they're pretty much normal reactions to a very difficult situation. Is that kind of what you meant?
I'm not going to say yes to that because I'm not sure what you're saying.
Okay. I think that sometimes when people are working, when clinicians are working with people who stutter, they may see secondary behaviors, they may see avoidance behaviors, they may see shame and guilt that might seem pretty bizarre to them. But then if you really know stuttering, and if you really know the experience of people who stutter going through speech therapy, I don't think these behaviors seem so bizarre anymore. So, like, for example, going to a restaurant and ordering something you don't want to eat because you can say it.
Yeah, because you can say it.
That
yeah.
might seem bizarre to people. And when I share stories like that in a class, and I see people who are in disbelief that actually happens.
No, you don't.
Well, I don't think it's that abnormal for people who stutter. For people who stutter, that's pretty normal.
Peter, that's the thing. When I go back and reread these articles particularly that I have, I just always made sure I kept a copy of most of the articles that I had published. And but I'm constantly amazed at what I read.
Well, I'll try to amaze you a little more. I don't know if you get this, Dr. Cooper, but it seems to me that when I get questions about stuttering from my colleagues, it's almost always along the lines of, what speech tool should I use? What speaking strategy do you recommend? So it's usually like, oh, hey, Peter, I'm working with a 10-year-old who stutters. What speaking strategy should I use? Why do you think so many speech pathologists ask questions like that? Like, why is it always, I work with a 12-year-old who stutters, what speech tool should I use?
Because it's easy. It doesn't require any thought. So much of the material that's published in terms of that are little kind of gimmicky kinds of things that are activities that people hope help a person develop the feeling of control, but they don't think in terms of that. But there's a lot of stuff out there that if the person doesn't have a complete understanding of stuttering or a major understanding, then you're going to get those kinds of questions. But that's kind of sad. I mean, when people do that to me, then I say, well, I refer them back to sources where they can read about it.
Yeah, I generally do that too, but my experience has been that when I refer people to sources, I get the feeling that nobody
does
actually
it.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm of the mind that if people want something to read about stuttering, they're going to come up to you and say, can you recommend an article? Can you recommend a book?
Yeah.
And nobody ever does that. I don't think I've ever had anyone come up to me and say, can you recommend an article I can read on stuttering?
Yeah.
So when people come up to me and they say, what speech tool should I use? I think they want a short answer. I don't think anybody wants to go home.
Yeah, the way I, you know, if they just came up and bluntly asked me that, I'd say, well, I said, I can't do that because I don't know your client well enough to know all of his feelings and his attitudes, and I don't know him enough to tell you what you need to do. You need to do it in the context. You better go get some ideas of how you approach various problems.
Yeah.
I give them a lecture, make them feel bad.
It's so interesting because, like, this stuff happens so often. So I'll say to somebody, well, I really can't tell you in 30 seconds how you're going to work with a client that I don't know.
I've got to know your client before I can begin to tell you what to do.
But then I'll get the question, okay, well, yeah, I totally understand that. But generally speaking, what speech tool should I use? Okay. When I was prepping for this show, I called Walter Manning and I said, I know you know Dr. Cooper well. So Dr. Manning, of course, was saying how great you are and how much you helped him personally. And he said to me that he shared with you a joke once that you have received the honors of the American Speech Language Hearing Association, ASHA, which is very prestigious. And Dr. Manning said to me that he's joked to you that if you weren't such a pain in the ass, you would have received the honors a lot quicker.
Yeah, someone once said I provide the profession with ambulatory itching powder.
I mean, what do you think were some of the things you did or said during your time that annoyed people, that they found upsetting or they didn't want to hear?
I think that's true. There's real evidence that, I wrote a series of articles about one lover's quarrel with his profession. I don't know if you ever come across those.
Because I haven't seen those.
A lover's quarrel with the world. Well, I'll stick some copies of this stuff that, I did quite a bit of writing about the profession, licensure laws and stuff like that, other than stuttering. And so I became known as, kind of a curmudgeon with respect to, pointing out what we were doing wrong.
Well, is there one main point you want to bring up now? Like, is there one main point of what you thought the profession did wrong that you want to share with us now?
My really major concern is that the ancillary, like the Council of Graduate Programs, which I was the chair of, got that going, and they could have, they ended up folding into ASHA. And that was the whole point that, we wanted a variety of independent organizations that, could attend to what their needs are. But what has ASHA done? But these different groups have just sort of melded in with ASHA and under that structure. It's curbed their ability to go in their own direction, if I'm making any sense. For example, I was very instrumental in setting up these divisions, and the more and more they're drawn under the umbrella of the association, and so you get this control from the top down. It kind of curbs the creativity of the various organizations.
Yeah, and I've heard other people say that. And what it's unfortunate because people will say that to me off air, and you're retired now, so it doesn't really matter. But so many people are afraid to say that on air, what you just said. That seems to be a lot of fear. There seems like speech-language pathologists seem very afraid these days of saying anything that's going to annoy the powers to be at ASHA. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and my point is that ASHA should not have become this all-encompassing kind of thing, but that it, you know, if it's divisions, they should somehow remain some autonomy, so that they can develop ideas and issues that they can then bring into the major group. But you're right. The way they've micromanaged now, that kind of thinking doesn't get into the hopper. If that's has any meaning or not.
Yeah, it does. And unfortunately, there's some points I want to bring up, but I'll have to share them with you off air, because everybody's scared of getting called to the principal's office.
Yeah.
Which is really unfortunate.
You do get frustrated.
Yeah,
bureaucracy.
Well, I want to ask you this as a closing question.
Okay.
You've come in contact with many, many good people in the field. Who is somebody you really learned from? Who's a mentor in the area of stuttering that was really smart and that really taught you something?
Well, there were several. I don't know that I would consider them mentors, but I'll be happy to name people that I really admired a lot. And then, of course, Joseph Sheehan was one.
Yeah.
That I, became simpatico with over the years, and I thought that his work, and of course Oliver Bloodstein's contributions early on, and his handbook on stuttering specifically, served the generations of students. And you know, his handbook back in 20 years ago or 30 years ago was the major text in almost every training program in the country. And so I admire him as a, and of course people like Wendell Johnson. You know, Wendell Johnson was another one that was key. And when I was with the federal government for briefly, I was his. He had a grant, and it was being supported by the Vocational Rehabilitation Service on his research. So I got to know him there, and then he died right in the middle of it, and so.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to think of others that, and of course, you know, I'm so super proud of Walt and David Daly, was a student of mine. Tom Crow was a student of mine, and these people are really fine contributors to the thing.
Actually, I have one more question to ask you. You have led and been a participant in many, many conferences and workshops over the years. And there's always talk about how at the stuttering meetings, there's always disagreements and pretty strong conversations. Can you remember any particular meetings or discussions that really stick out to you, like something fun that you'd like to share?
Oh, yeah, one of my wife's reminding me of one of my favorite stories. This occurred out at Monterey Peninsula in California, and it was funded by our agency, the Vocational Rehab, brought together all the many, many of the leaders of the stuttering group. And it was a reading of who's who in stuttering that was at the meeting. And so that on a break one time, they took us on a bus and toured around. Have you ever been out there, Carmel, by the sea?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And
Route 1.
Huh?
I said it's right on Route 1, yeah.
That's right. That's right. And so they took us on a bus ride and over to the cliffs and stuff like that. And the bus driver was so anxious to please us all, he wanted to get as close as possible. So this big bus, and he got too close, and literally the back wheel started to slide over.
Oh, wow.
And I was sitting next to Wishner, and you're looking down at the sea, you know, I don't know how many feet below you. And it was one of those horrible moments, you know, so you said, oh, my God, are we going to go over? And everybody just sat absolutely still, and thank God the bus driver, he got us out of the mess and pulled us up and over. And someone said, my God, they almost set Stuttering back 100 years. And Wishner, sitting right beside me, yelled out, he said, or put it ahead.
That's great.
And so everybody burst out laughing when we just needed. But anyway, that was a great moment.
So I wasn't sure if you had any stories about some of the late greats really having some disagreements or not seeing eye to eye.
Well, one thing that was on the, it was interesting when, and this isn't the greats, Bill Perkins, this was years and years ago, the topic was something about the psychology of stuttering or something, and, so I got up, and the group was invited to discuss it, and Perkins was at the last person in the thing, and he stood up and he said, "Well, now that you've heard all those fairy tales, this is the way it really is." And
oh.
He presented his operant conditioning model at that time that he was using, but those were kind of great moments in theater.
Wow.
For me.
And I don't want to keep you all day, so I think we should end things here.
Yeah,
but,
I'm tired you out, so.
No, it's great. I really can't thank you enough. I want to remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. Peter Wright is speaking with Dr. Eugene Cooper. Dr. Cooper, I hope we can lull you out of retirement again to come back and visit with us.
I would be delighted to do so.
Okay, thanks a lot.